All this week, we'll be visiting some of the world's edgiest cities, as seen through the eyes of crime novelists. It's the latest in our summer reading series, Crime in the City. We begin in Scotland, but a Scotland that's well off the tourist maps. Vicky Barker has been touring Glasgow's mean streets with the crime writer Denise Mina.
Wherever you go in Glasgow, seagulls cartwheel high above you, refugees from distant North Atlantic storms. They call out caustic, airborne editorials on the gentrified city center and on the slums that sprawl around it. Slums like Easter House, a public housing project hemmed in by highways. As Denise Mina describes it in her novel, The Dead Hour, it's one of the roughest ghettos in Europe.
The most malcontent city centre populations had been moved to the satellite estates, a long bus ride away from spontaneous social upheaval. Without the presence of a common enemy, frustration fermented among the people and they began to eat themselves. If Easter House had a heraldic shield, it would need symbols for drunkenness, medication and despair.
Left here?
Left and then left again at the lights.
This is Denise Mina's turf. Her vivid, pacey crime novels are peopled by small-time criminals, battered women, shifty journalists at failing papers. The heroine of her well-received Garnet Hill trilogy, Maureen O'Donnell, is a psychiatric patient and survivor of sexual abuse whose married lover is found with his throat slit in her living room. Their characters, Mina, a former criminologist and longtime Glasgow resident, knows well.
It's very hard to be cut off in Glasgow because it's such a small city. You know, we have the highest rate of per capita imprisonment, certainly in Britain, maybe in Europe. We have a very high murder rate here. So most people will know someone who's been to prison. Oh, Liam's house is up here. Actually, go straight on and I'll show you where Liam lives.
Now, Liam doesn't actually exist. He's her protagonist Maureen's devoted brother and a drug dealer.
Usually when I'm trying to establish a character, I try and find out where they live. So that's Liam's house there, the white one. It's a big rambling house. And not very long ago, these houses, quite a lot of them were derelict and they all had mattresses in the garden. And that's where Liam lives.
And this is the press bar, which figures in another cycle of Denise Mina novels. In reality, as in fiction, it's an overwhelmingly male retreat for the hard-drinking hacks who write for the paper next door. It is here that aspiring reporter Patty Meehan grapples with sexism and insecurities about her weight and with prejudice about her Catholic background. This is a city where the sectarian divide between Protestant and Catholic runs as deep as it does in Belfast through all classes of society.
If you went for a job interview in a Glasgow law firm, they used to ask you what school you went to, and that was a way of finding out what religion you were.
Several of Denise Mina's books are set in the 1980s. That's when this city, once as dynamic an economic powerhouse as Chicago, was convulsed by the economic restructuring under Margaret Thatcher. Factories, mines, and shipyards closed. Thousands of men would never work again. And it was in the 1980s that Denise Mina returned to the city of her birth, a high school dropout, broke, and unemployed.
People didn't say, what do you do for a living? No one was defined by their jobs, which I loved. In Glasgow, people said, do you work? Which I thought was very kind.
The city itself was crumbling.
There were beautiful neo-Gothic architecture with big bushes growing out of it. It was like the bomb had dropped here. It was like the 80s were a bomb that dropped here and everyone was just kind of coming, blinking out into the light.
At one point on this tour, as if on cue, a hearse overtakes us. Denise Mina laughs. This crime writer laughs a lot.
This is Glasgow University. I just got an honorary degree from Glasgow University and I had to wear very painful shoes so that I didn't laugh all the way through the ceremony because I felt like an outlaw.
We drive past stately red and yellow sandstone houses, Regency and Art Deco relics of Glasgow's past.
You could stop here and we could get out and walk around, maybe.
We're at the top of a steep hill lined with 3- and 4-story tenement buildings, many undergoing renovation. This is Garnet Hill, the title and the setting for Mina's first novel. Walking through this neighborhood of immigrants, artists, and increasingly yuppies, Mina says reality is what drove her to fiction.
I was doing a PhD in mental illness and female offenders, and I've discovered really interesting things about what happens when people are mentally ill, how they're treated afterwards, as if they never have agency afterwards. And I thought, if I write a PhD thesis about this, no one's ever going to read it, but if I put it in a crime fiction novel, lots of people will read it.
So she created Maureen O'Donnell, the depressive and incest survivor. When the police and even her own family suspect her of her lover's murder, Maureen is forced to hunt for the killer herself. Garnet Hill won a Crime Writers Association Award for Best First Novel.
I think it really chimes with people that she uses rational deduction to find things out, even though she has a history of depression. In fact, people with depression are better at that because they're less blinkered by hope. He said, is this a karaoke?
Mina says her characters become so real to her, she once tried to look one of them up on Facebook. She says she prefers her heroes unsung.
I think anyone can run into a burning building, but actually living with dignity with schizophrenia for 30 years is breathtakingly brave. Those are the kinds of heroes that I want to talk about, as people, ordinary people who do amazing things day to day, but we never really sort of celebrate them.
Thank you.
The wind has picked up on Garnet Hill. Mina takes refuge in a nearby cinema. And the conversation turns to female icons.
A drunk woman is no one's icon. A violent woman is no one's icon. You know, I always wanted to take characters who were disregarded and look at their perspective. Because those are the sorts of people who are going to find their boyfriend dead in their living room. People with slightly chaotic lives.
Mina is 40, looks 25, listens to heavy metal music, and is proud of her working class roots. But her readers tend to be professional women in their 50s, with whom Mina's been surprised to discover a profound sense of kinship.
I did a reading to four people in LA, and we could have lived together. We could have set up a commune, and we could hardly speak at the end of it because there was such a connection. We were just sort of patting one another's elbows. You know, and as the books get bigger and bigger, I know those people aren't going to come up and talk to me at the end, but it's one of the nicest things that's ever happened to me in my life, is knowing that they're out there.
For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in Glasgow, Scotland.
All this month, we're examining the effect race has on politics. Many of you have logged on to our website to let us know how race will influence your vote in the upcoming election. Later, two of our listeners will share their experiences. But first, we remember a tragic event that happened 100 years ago in Springfield, Illinois. On August 14, 1908, a group of white people formed a violent mob. It erupted into riots that killed seven people, destroyed dozens of black-owned homes and businesses, and ran most of the city's black population out of town. The Springfield race riots shook the state capital that is well known as the home of President Abraham Lincoln.
Liberals in the North were so outraged by the symbolism of this violence occurring in Lincoln's hometown that they announced their intent on Lincoln's birthday in 1909 to form a new organization whose prime initial goal would be to fight anti-black violence. And the NAACP was formally organized less than a year after that.
That's Roberta Seneschal de la Roche. She's a professor of history at Washington and Lee University. She says the riots were set off by two incidents. The first was the alleged murder of a white man by a black man. The second was a white woman's accusation that a black man had raped her.
The crowd formed at the downtown jail demanding that the county sheriff hand over the two black suspects. They clearly wanted to mete out lethal justice there on the spot.
Local authorities decided to move the suspects so they wouldn't get lynched. That action angered the mob.
At least as many as 500, possibly as many as 1,000 people went to the black business district and systematically destroyed and looted virtually every black business downtown.
The rioting went on for 2 days. Five white men and two black men were killed in the violence. One of the black victims was 80-year-old William Donegan, a retired shoemaker and real estate dealer. Members of the mob beat him with bricks, slashed his throat with a razor, and finally put a rope around his neck and tied him to a tree.
These largely working-class rioters were expressing resentment over visible black success and influence in the community.
Some of the perpetrators were indicted, something like 107 indictments. About 80 people were charged.
Roughly.
But there was only one conviction?
Well, there were two, actually, but they're very minor. One got off with a minor property charge, and I think he had to pay a $5 fine and got 30 days in jail. And then there was a young teenager sent to a reformatory for 6 months. But considering how many indictments there were and the fact that so many people saw the rioters, on the face of it, it looks remarkable. From the perspective of many Springfield residents who were white, justice was not done in the end.
Mm. The woman who claimed that she had been assaulted later recanted her claim, and she said what she said to cover up an affair.
Yeah, we don't know for certain. Something funny was going on there, probably an affair. One of the sad things, looking back, is that the white press that had helped so much to fan the flames of anger had virtually nothing to say by way of shock or apology or anything.
Roberta Seneschal de la Roche teaches history at Washington and Lee University. Her book about the Springfield race riots of 1908, In Lincoln's Shadow, was recently re-released to commemorate the event. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Imagine, it's the year 1940. Jews are looking for a place to call home. Israel is falling apart, so a piece of land is carved out for Jews thousands of miles away, in Alaska. That's where Michael Chabon's novel The Yiddish Policeman's Union begins. Last night, the book earned Chabon a Hugo Award for Best Novel. A Hugo is like a Pulitzer, but from the World Science Fiction Society. I told Michael Chabon that his book sure doesn't sound like science fiction.
Well, the book is flexible or agile in its approach to literary genres, but I think more than anything else, that's a mark of how flexible those genre distinctions can be and are. And I mean, so, you know, the world of science fiction, or let's call it the territory of science fiction, has very porous boundaries. And there's definitely room in it for a work of alternate history, which is sort of the portal into which this novel passes into the land of science fiction.
Your alternate history here is pretty alternate. Just a quick sketch.
Well, all alternate history, I think if it's done in the usual manner, it all starts with one change, one small difference. In the case of this novel, there was this bill that was introduced into Congress in 1940, and it would have allowed an unspecified but presumably rather large number of Jewish refugees from Europe to enter into the United States. This is actually before the U.S. Entered World War II, and it proposed allowing them to settle in Alaska on a temporary basis, just as kind of a shelter to get them out of harm's way. But in the world of this novel, the plan actually eventually comes to pass, and as a result, you have ultimately, if you combine the immigration before the war and then the people who came after the conclusion of the war, you end up with a couple million people living up there in Sitka, Alaska.
Can I ask you, what do you think of other work that's going on in science fiction right now? Do you read science fiction?
Yes, I do. I still read science fiction, and I see all kinds of diversity. I think I find a very intense, ongoing kind of intellectual and aesthetic debate in the world of science fiction. The people who are reading it and the people who are writing it seem to me to be engaged in an ongoing conversation about the fiction that they love on a level that I think is enviable, that would be a credit to the world of mainstream fiction.
I understand the Coen brothers are working on a movie of your novel.
Yes, that's what I'm told.
You haven't spoken with them.
No, I haven't.
For our listeners, they made Fargo, they made No Country for Old Men, Raising Arizona, among other great films.
Miller's Crossing.
Yes,
one of my favorites, and The Big Lebowski, of course.
Of course.
Yeah, no, that's the idea, at least. And I've been told they're working on the screenplay, right now, which is very exciting for me to contemplate. And I can't imagine better suited filmmakers to this material. They've proven how comfortable and skilled they are at handling noirish kind of material over and over again. And then to add this layer of kind of this loopy, skewed Jewish America that never existed. It just feels to me like a perfect match for them.
What are you working on now?
I'm writing a novel.
Huh.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Let's see if I can, you know, rack up a maybe a, one of the romance awards.
Harlequin. Whatever they call them. I don't know what they are either.
No, this is a mainstream, more of a mainstream kind of novel. It's set in recognizable present-day consensus reality, at least so far.
Superpowers?
No superpowers yet.
Yet.
You never know. It's early days still.
Michael Chabon won a Hugo Award last night for his novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. Thanks so much for taking the time to
talk to us. My pleasure. Thank you very much. I'm happy to do so.
How sad for dead writers to have missed the internet. Why, young people may never encounter them. A British literary award, the Orwell Prize, it goes for political writing, sees a way around that. Tomorrow, and every day for the next 4 years, it will publish a daily blog by the author of 1984 and Animal Farm and many, many political essays. This is quite a trick. George Orwell has been dead for 58 years. Gene Seaton is director of the Orwell Prize and a professor of media history at the University of Westminster. She joins us from the BBC Bush House in London. Professor Seaton, welcome. How are you going to do this?
Well, we're going to publish in real time, as it were. We thought that was a really interesting way of actually letting people into a diary day by day, as Orwell wrote it, in a really critical part of his life, when he was coming into himself, really, as a very great writer and a very great political mind.
And you got the idea of publishing several years of his diary as a daily blog 70 years to the day after he wrote these pieces. So that's what you're going to do. These are his diary entries, and you're going to do this for the next several years, just like a blog.
You see a big volume of diaries. It feels kind of only, it feels rather academic in a way. I mean, they're big, they're an important part of the writing. Some of it's very original. You can see it going straight into the literature. But if you're an ordinary person, you know, kind of it feels remote. If you do it day by day, particularly, I think, we're starting now and we're in the run-up to the breakout of the Second World War.
World War II. So this is 1938, and George Orwell is actually, as he begins writing this, he's in Morocco. He's come there from he had a war wound. He fought in the Spanish Civil War. He's wounded, and he's down in Morocco, kind of recuperating.
Absolutely, and from TB as well. But he knows war is coming. And it seems to me that if you publish bits of the diary, people reading it get a sense of that unfolding daily reality.
So what is it that George Orwell is writing about 70 years ago that readers today are going to want to follow the way they do daily blogs?
I think he's writing about what the world looks like when a world war is imminent and the world is trembling on a very uncomfortable brink.
Okay, here's an excerpt. This is an excerpt from the diary, and we're pleased that you have managed to bring in George Orwell's son, his adopted son, Richard Blair, to read an excerpt from the diary. Here it is.
Marrakesh, 27th of September, 1938. All the troops here are said to be standing by and ready to move at a moment's notice. On the fortified hill immediately west of the town, there are guns which command the Arab quarter. Nevertheless, the local French show an utter lack of interest in the European crisis, so much so as to make it impossible to think that they believe war will break out. There is no scramble for papers, no one broaches the subject of war, and one hears no conversations on the subjects in the cafes.
That's an excerpt from George Orwell's diary, published as a blog every day for the next several years. Gene Seaton is director of the Orwell Prize, which is publishing it. You know, Gene, this is a diary, but it's not sort of really a personal diary, is it? It doesn't sound like I'm angry with my sister or that kind of thing.
I couldn't possibly let out some of our scoops. There are one or two bits of sex that are going to come up. He spends his energy as writers do. They manage things by writing. And he's writing his everyday life, what's going on. And he's observing. I mean, I think what you've got is Orwell practicing being a writer and Orwell ever rapaciously hungry for evidence about the world around him. when he has a lung hemorrhage later on in the diary, does he say, "I nearly died yesterday"? Does he say it was a really bad thing? He says no. He's British, of that generation. He says lungs not too good, you know. So, you know,
this is his diary entry for a lung hemorrhage which nearly killed him.
Yes, you know, stoicism is an unfashionable virtue, but it's one I think is undervalued.
Here's another excerpt. He's writing about his garden.
Marrakesh, 16th of March, 1939. Yesterday, not quite so hot. Overcast and clouds of dust. Ditto today. Probably presaging rain. Men still plying in places. Yesterday, a man sowing, broadcast out of a bag. Flocks of domestic pigeons swooping down to try and steal the seed. And the men chasing them off. Yesterday saw a very young camel cub, evidently only a few days born, as it had a bit of navel string. Nevertheless, its legs were almost as long as its mother's. Cavalry passing yesterday. Note that all the horses seem to be stallions.
That's George Orwell's adopted son, Richard Blair, reading from his diaries. Gene Seaton, you're a professor of media history. What do you learn reading these diaries, listening to these diaries? What do you learn about George Orwell?
I learn most of all, the thing that's really compelling, actually, I think, about the diaries, is the going and seeing and having your views amended. That unwillingness to be, as it were, hoodwinked by conventions is why he's such a powerful voice. He's always warning us, use your eyes, use your ears, use your faculties, live, and use all of that to make sure that you are not falling into conventional and dangerous habits of political mind.
So if he were alive today, he would be a blogger?
I think he would have been, because he's completely obsessed. You know, he's going to write 1984. I mean, he's one of the first people that alerts us to the shaping power of the media as they were then. Elsewhere in the Morocco diary, he says, you know, they read this newspaper, these are where they get the information from. This. So I think that he would have been right out there in the vanguard of technological, you know, access to people's hearts and minds, because that's what he was interested in.
Gene Seaton is director of the British Literary Award, the Orwell Prize. Tomorrow it begins publishing in blog form, George Orwell's Diary. Gene Seaton, thank you, and thanks also to Richard Blair, the adopted son of George Orwell.
Patricia Nell Warren wrote a novel in 1974 that's important to millions. The Front Runner tells the story of Billy Sive, a young track star who is fast, gifted, and gay, proudly, unabashedly gay, and he wants to represent his country in the 1976 Olympics. The book was considered daring and controversial when it was published. In many ways, it still is. It contains frank accounts of gay life in the early 70s. And yet the frontrunner long ago leapt from the shelves of so-called gay fiction to become one of the best-selling novels of recent times, selling 10 million copies in 8 languages. As the Olympic Games open in Beijing, Patricia Nell Warren has a new book out, The Lavender Locker Room, a collection of essays about sports figures from a 13th-century jouster named Jean Le Poussel, you may know her as Joan of Arc, to Big Bill Tilden, the tennis star, David Coppé, the football player, and the great Martina Navratilova. Patricia Nell Warren joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I think it's fair to say that you are a touchstone for many young gays in sports. Are there still closeted gays in sports?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly, there have been significant changes since the 1970s, but it isn't all that easy, especially in team sports.
And review for us some of the hesitation they have.
Well, in team sports, you not only can run into unpleasantness and attitudes from your teammates, but your coach, the team owners, the sponsors. It can get very complicated in team sports. It's a little bit easier in the sports where you compete as an individual, and so that's why we've had more people out, lesbians and gay men, bisexuals, and transgendered people as well in equestrian sports and tennis and golf and so forth.
So someone like Martina Navratilova can be as outspoken and, for that matter, as admired as she is.
Yes, but it wasn't easy for her. It was very scary during those early years when she was thinking of not just coming out, but also defecting from her native country and coming to the United States.
Let me ask about some of the people that you talk about in this book. You do write about figure skaters, especially John Curry.
Yes. He sold his style to the judges, and not only that, he came out before he went to the Olympics, which was quite amazing. Mm-hmm. Here was somebody who dared to take figure skating in a very artistic direction, and that's still a battle that they're duking out in figure skating today, and especially in men's skating. Are you going to be athletic, or are you going to be artistic?
I have to ask what Joan of Arc is doing in the book.
Being that I grew up on a ranch and I grew up in equestrian sports and competed in equestrian sports when I was younger, I have never bought the idea that Joan of Arc was somehow this ignorant farm girl who somehow magically was able to get up on a horse, a schooled war horse, and distinguish herself with feats of arms, with swords and lances. She had to have had some background in this. I just don't buy the conventional story.
You might be familiar with the news this week that the government in Beijing is not permitting Joey Cheek, the Olympic medalist, who I think many people have a very warm memory of for establishing a foundation to aid Darfur, and he's been an activist. I wonder if that gives you any reflections on the Chinese government's policies towards gays.
In the Athens Olympics, there were 11 athletes from different countries who were publicly out and competed in Athens. And it's interesting to note that this year there are only 6 out athletes. And I imagine that probably some of the people who went to the Athens game have felt just a little bit deterred by the fact that they're still harassing gay activists in China and they harass people with HIV. And I think that they would have a concern about being there.
Can I direct a couple of front runner questions to you?
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
I gather the novel has been optioned for a film many times.
Yes.
And never made, obviously. In a day when a film like Brokeback Mountain can become so popular, what's the hesitation been about the front runner for some people?
Well, there was the time when the hesitation was more about Hollywood being afraid of dealing with the subject. I think today the big issue is the budget. This is going to have to be a big budget film. You don't make a film about the Olympic Games for $2 million.
It must have happened that a lot of people come up to you and say, the front runner, opened my eyes, changed my life. At this point, has it been more gay or straight people? Or do you keep score?
A lot of people think that my books have appealed only to men. Mm-hmm. And actually, I would say that the readership of the front runner is probably 40 or 45% female. The fact that the book has been on the New York Times bestseller list, I get a lot of feedback from straight people, from parents who tell me that the book opened their eyes about the needs and aspirations of their gay children. I heard wonderful stories about smuggling my book into South Africa back when it was a dictatorship.
What do you hear from gay athletes these days?
You know, there are so many different areas now. We have our own World Cups in rugby and soccer, and we're creating our own international basketball leagues and our own golf leagues, and, you know, very much making certain sports our own so that we don't have to be quite so dependent on getting our foot in the door at the Olympics or the mainstream world-class competitions.
Billy Sive would be almost 60 now, wouldn't he?
Yes. Shocking.
I wonder if you sometimes use that character to measure evident visible change in the world today?
Well, I think today it's interesting to look back on that time and on all of the real-life Billy Sives that there were out there in sports in the 60s and 70s, because that was a huge watershed in our history, that period. Mm-hmm. And all of the big changes that took place in civil rights for the black community, the women's community, were reflected in changes in the sports world as well. So it's interesting to look at Billy and through that lens and see how far the sports world has come and where it still needs to go.
Patricia Nell Warren, author of the classic novel, The Front Runner. Her new book, available from her own publishing company, Wildcat Press, is called The Lavender Locker Room. Miss Warren, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on the show.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.